Right, so our little light says on air is lit up. It's time for us to begin our Wednesday evening service. So tonight we're going to finish up our study of syllogisms, and I'm just going to run through really quickly where we're at and what we've gotten to, because we're going to see the ultimate syllogism come out tonight from the blind man himself. So if you recall, a syllogism is a form of reasoning in which a conclusion is drawn, whether valid or not, from two premises. It's a very simple, very short statement from a logic standpoint, but it can have a lot of sway in an argument. The two we've looked at are hypothetical and categorical. The rules must have exactly three terms. Two negative premises yield no conclusion. Two positive premises yield a positive conclusion. A positive and a negative premise yields only a negative conclusion. So for something to be true, it has to be true. Everything has to be true. So if you're in a debate with somebody about something and you can just peel off one little premise, one little statement and show that that's false, then the whole argument becomes false. And this is really critical in law. They do this a lot in that world. If both premises are universal, the conclusion is also universal, and this is something we're going to see tonight. If the conclusion is all or none, then the premises must also be all or none. So if I say all cars have four wheels, and I say a Ford is a car, then my conclusion is that all Fords have four wheels, because it has to be an all or none situation. A couple of examples: all Christians are baptized is a major premise. The minor: Joe has not been baptized. The conclusion: Joe is not a Christian. We understand this. We can see this. A hypothetical just uses if-then statements. If Joe is a Christian, then he has been baptized. Joe has not been baptized, therefore Joe is not a Christian. Now, there are other types of syllogisms that you'll see in the scriptures. We're not going to go through that tonight. Okay, so we looked at some of the syllogisms that came from the Pharisees, and we looked at John 9, verse 16. Their major premise is all people who are from God keep the Sabbath. This man, Jesus, does not keep the Sabbath. Their conclusion is this man is not from God. Syllogism B, the imperfect form of it. Only people who are from God are those who are not sinners, can open the eyes of those born blind, or can do such things. The minor premise, this man Jesus has opened the eyes of one born blind or has done such a thing. Therefore, this man is from God or is not a sinner. Now, they didn't realize what they were doing, but they basically were showing the truth of the situation by trying to argue against it. Their implication, however, is really this: only the wicked suffer physical affliction. We talked about this at length. Back then, the belief was if you had a physical ailment, then you were a sinner, or your parents were sinners. Somewhere along the line, somebody sinned. That's why you had that ailment. Obviously, the man suffered a physical affliction, therefore he was a wicked man under their context. John 9:16, the perfect side of this, which is expanding really what they meant to say, is the same thing, except we've added a little bit of a phrase. Only people who are from God, who are not sinners, can open the eyes of those born blind, in order that by doing this they may display the works of God. This was the purpose behind the activity that Jesus did. It was never about him. It was always about bringing glory to God. Okay, but can we imply something there? If Jesus is bringing glory to God, then who else is he bringing glory to? Himself, but in a what way? As the Son of God, right? Because he is doing the work of God. And he is equal to God. Therefore, when God is glorified, he also is glorified. The minor premise was this man Jesus, with that purpose in mind, in other words, the purpose to glorify God, has opened the eyes of one born blind. Therefore, the conclusion is this man is from God. This man is not a sinner. Okay, so that's where we left it last week. We're going to continue on, and as I say this every week, hopefully we'll be able to finish with everything, but if we don't, that's okay. We'll get there. So let's go ahead and open with a word of prayer. Eric, would you mind leading us in prayer tonight? Amen. Okay, so we're going to start in verse 24 tonight. So if I could get somebody to read verses 24 through 34. Verses 24 through 34 of chapter 9.
Said therefore unto him, what did he do to thee? How opened he thine eyes? And he answered them, I told you even now, and he did, and you did not hear. Wherefore would ye hear it again? Why would ye also become his disciples? And they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken unto Moses, but as for this man, we know not whence he is. The man answered and said unto them, why? Wherein is this the marvel, that ye know not whence he is? And yet he opened my eyes. We know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and do his will, he heareth him. Since the world began, it was never heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, how could he do nothing? He answered and said unto him, thou wast altogether born in sin, and dost thou teach us? And they cast him out. Jesus heard that they cast him out.
You can go ahead and stop there. Yeah, that's okay. Okay, there's a lot going on here. Now, we're going to contrast. What was the parents' response when they questioned the parents? Do you remember?
Ask him.
But what were they afraid of? The expulsion. So they were not going to give him up one way or the other. They had no desire, I believe, to speak the truth, even if they knew the truth of the situation, because of what they were afraid of. And this is something we see with a lot of people in the New Testament when it comes to Jesus. Yes?
They were saying, we said last week, this is a grown man, don't ask us, go to him.
Right. And that was the safe answer, right? So he has no timidity in his life, because he's going to stand there and he's going to be proud to say what he's about to say. Which most people coming in front of the Pharisees or the Sanhedrin, if they were in front of the Sanhedrin at some point, would not want to speak that way. Aaron.
I also like what Gil brought up last week as far as the rigidity of the law as it pertains to the witnesses. I guess one could think that there might be some sort of at least character witness going on, other than it just seems a little black and white for the family. And I do agree about they're more afraid of getting kicked out of the synagogue. But I also like to keep in mind what Gil said last week about, you know what? It is a really rigid set of boundaries as far as when you are witness to something, you say, this is what I know, everything else is not allowed to be said, that sort of thing. So, like, just the facts, ma'am. So I like to try to keep that in mind, but I do believe it's a little bit of a, like, if it was my kid, I mean, you're like throwing up, you know, he's being, like, there's no sense of defense of.
Yeah, please have mercy on him. Yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about, or, you know. Yeah. Cut him a break, you know, that type of thing. Yeah.
And so there is that sense of coldness, but there is also that side of it as well, that is just them keeping to the letter of the law.
Yeah.
Which are a lot better at the people that were accusing them.
Eric, did you have a point? Yeah, so hang on that because we're going to get to that. Yeah, that's all of that's really significant, verses 31 through 34. So you're on the right track there. Okay, so he then makes a comment, and I try to picture in my mind what this is like. What, do you have a thing for him? Are you his disciples too? You know, that type of thing. Why do you keep harping on him? Why do you keep talking about him? You must have some sort of thing for him, so you must be one of his disciples. That's kind of the rhetoric that he's bringing to them. You know, it's like if somebody's asking about this girl, you know, in middle school and keeps asking and asking, and somebody else finally says, why do you like her? You know, is there, oh no, I don't, I just, I'm curious, but I don't like her. Well, obviously there's something going on here where they want to know more about him. So why do you want to hear this again? What point is it going to serve for me to say all of this again? Well, here's the reason why I think it is. Because again, if you ask the question and keep asking and keep asking, you're hoping that maybe you get an answer that is different from the first answer. And again, in our arguments, if I answer a different way that refutes what I just said, therefore my whole entire thing is refuted. Okay? So what they're trying to show here is it wasn't Jesus that healed you. And I want you to notice something. Do they ever call him by name? It's that man, that fellow. That guy over there. It's always in this very derogatory situation. And what they're saying here is that we want you to say that you know that God delivered you from this blindness, not Jesus. We'll acknowledge that he slapped some mud on your face and did all of that work, but it wasn't him who brought sight to you. It was God and God alone. Exactly, or some other something else happened, but they wanted him to acknowledge he was God. And of course, he comes back, and that's not his response to them. And so they then respond back, and they say, and different versions are going to have different words. I have the word abusive, reviled. I think somebody else had a different word. Yours was a little bit different, I think. They reviled him and said, you are that fellow's, remember, here we go, that fellow's disciple. Okay, well, the only thing that this guy that we know is he had his eyes opened because he was blind, and now all of a sudden he's been a lifelong follower of Christ. But this gets to the heart of how one becomes a disciple. Where does it start? Evidence, okay, which leads to faith, belief, and that's what would get you kicked out. If you acknowledged and believed in Christ, you were excommunicated from the synagogue. And when we talked about that last week, if you were excommunicated, it wasn't like, okay, here's all your papers and, you know, we'll your tote and everything is ready to go. Let us know if you ever need anything. No, you were completely removed from it. So if he was a beggar before, he's now even worse than a beggar because he doesn't have any place to go beg. So they decide to get to that point. But the issue here is that they will not admit defeat. They are going to keep at this and keep at this and keep at this. And they're not happy because he defied their authority, or their perceived authority, I will say, on this ridiculous set of rules and stuff that they've put together based on the law of Moses. So what he has done is he has taken their position and he has exalted a superior syllogism, a superior position to all of this. Now, do you think they were ever considering to be disciples of Jesus? This is a trick question. Because there were some who did. If we turn over to John chapter 12, so go to John chapter 12 and go down to verse 42. If I could have somebody read John 12, verse 42 and 43. Is that 12:40? Am I in the right place? Yeah, John 12:42.
It says, "Nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the approval of men rather than the approval of God."
Okay. So before we saw belief. Belief is what would get you kicked out. Now it's confession will get you kicked out. But see, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. So they believed what they saw, but they loved what man could do for them more than what they felt God could do for them.
Or feared,
right. So they did not want to confess him. So, yes, there were people that were there. And we've kind of seen this story because if we look at when they were in the Feast of Tabernacles and they were talking and some were saying, well, wait a minute, isn't this the group that wanted to do this? And others were saying, well, maybe he did say this. Maybe he did do this. And so there was even banter and fighting going on amongst the people because they weren't sure of what was going on. And so we see that there are Pharisees, I believe, that were probably there that didn't necessarily agree with what these other Pharisees were saying and doing. Okay. So there's no way in the world that a majority of these would become a disciple of Christ because his name was poison to them. It was anathema to them. And again, you can see that because they're referencing him as that fellow or that guy or, you know, something along that line. Okay, so they decide to do what? They call themselves who? We are the disciples of Moses. Okay, got to throw the Moses story out again, right? And if I was Jesus, I'd be like, look, guys, we've already been down this path four times already. We've talked about it, so let's regurgitate one of the stories, John chapter 5. If somebody could read verses 45 and 46 for me. Because obviously the Pharisees don't remember, so hopefully we do. John 5, verses 45 and 46. Read 46 and 47. That's okay. I didn't say that, so.
For had he believed Moses, he would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if he believed not his writings, how shall he believe my words?
Ouch. Ouch. This guy, who you claim to be a disciple of, he wrote about me. And, oh, by the way, if you don't believe in me, then you don't believe in his writings, which means you don't believe in his law and his testimony. That's pretty harsh. So it's not like they haven't heard this already. This is not new to them.
So Jesus wouldn't be accusing them of being apostate.
And of course, Jesus is not in present right now, but I'm just thinking about this is what they've already been through. So they know God spoke to Moses. They know this. They know the story. They had it memorized. Matter of fact, and we've talked about this, but just to bring it to your remembrance, the day that the Israelites received the law at the base of the mountain is the same Jewish day of the day of Pentecost. Okay? So there is no happenstance, right? All these things happen for a reason. 3,000 people were killed because of what they did when the law was given. 3,000 people were saved when the law of Christ was given. So there's these little things that we see happening. You could pass right over them.
I like also the fact that he's bringing up something that the Pharisees and the Sadducees both understand to be true. Because like we have studied before, there is the five, and then there's everything else around that. And so you have the Pharisees, they did all of it, but the Sadducees only did the five.
Yeah.
So this is coming from the five. So this is...
Yeah, so everybody at least agreed on the five. Yeah.
This idea of talking about them about Abraham, who that is.
Yeah, they know who that is. Yep.
Except as the truth. The entire company accepts the truth. And as opposed to like talking about Job, maybe for the answers of how, not necessarily because of somebody's sin, are you being persecuted, then you might have the Sadducees going, I see, I told you you shouldn't read those books, those sort of things.
So what Aaron's referring to is the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, both the Pharisees and the Sadducees believed in, but that was it for the Sadducees. Once you got to the prophets, they disregarded the prophets. So everybody's in accord when it comes to the first five books. So they know the divine origin of the law. They know where it came from. And they know the ordinance which Moses instituted through God's hand. What they did not know is that the one whom they hate with such a hatred is the one that Moses spoke of. And it's not because they weren't taught. It's not because they couldn't see it. Their eyes were blinded to this. But Jesus is going to use a play on words at the very end of this chapter, so I'll save it for that later. So then they said, well, we don't know who this guy is because we don't know where he's from. Have we heard this before? Here we go again. He wasn't in any of the schools. Was he registered in your school? I didn't see him there. Ethelene, was he in your school?
It was a for-profit school.
He says he graduated, but we have no records of that. So. So they are not denying that this man Jesus exists. They are not denying that he is somebody who has done this. They are denying the fact that he can be from God because they don't know anything about him. So they're basing this idea that we know Christ only through his lineage. Well, there's sort of a funny retort to that because the Bible's full of lineage. From the very beginning, we have the lineage. God made it very clear from day one what the lineage was so we could see that he is the Messiah when we get to that point. And again, this is not something that they would not have known.
As important as it is for the priest to be identified in the Old Testament by their lineage every single time. So when you say this priest, it's going to be son of next to it because of how important it was to identify that person as being legitimately a priest.
Yeah. I think part of it for me is that, and we talked about this in Intertestamental, we had gotten to a point now where high priests were like paid employees of the Roman government. They didn't come from that lineage. They didn't have that. And they knew this. And so they kind of had to justify themselves. So the best way to justify yourself is just to ignore the evidence against you. Yeah, exactly. So we're just going to bypass John Hyrcanus all the way down and that Caiaphas and Annas' other family members have all been a part of this. And there's two high priests at this point in time and all of those different things. We're just going to ignore all of that, even though we know specifically how the high priest was selected according to the scriptures. So they say, we don't know where he hails from. Now, they're really not talking about his location. They're not talking about where he was born. or where he's from that perspective. What he is really, or what they are really saying is this: we do not know what source he is from, in distinction from Moses. In other words, we don't know by what authority he is doing the things that he is doing. It wasn't from our authority. We did not tell him he could do this. He was not in any of the schools where he would have learned this. You know, when you go to magic school, you learn from other people who know magic, right? So all of these miracles, they don't want to recognize come directly from God. So their best way of saying this is that we don't know who gave him this authority. We don't know where this came from. And of course, Jesus had answered this over and over and over. So the man says, why is this astonishing to you? Why is this fact? He doesn't just say this statement. He says, why is this fact so astonishing? I don't know if he's a sinner or not, but what I can tell you is I was blind and now I can see. And this is a really important point for us as Christians. You can get into all the hustle and bustle of the scriptures and get down, and if you've got somebody you're talking to that's of a different religious base, and they have a tremendous amount of knowledge in that religion, they will argue with you to the nth degree, and they may over-argue you to the point where you can't win because you don't have the skills to fight back. All my answer is that, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but all I can tell you is I was blind, and now I can see. That's it. That's all I have to know. I don't have to have all of this other knowledge because that's all I need to know. And so this is a very important point that he's making, is that to become a child of God or to be in the kingdom of God, as Jesus is talking to them about, it's an acknowledgement and confession of him. Because a lot of these people already knew the scriptures. They already knew the text. So what he's asking them to do is to acknowledge that he is the Christ, that he is God's Messiah. Now, the funny thing is that in chapter 6, chapter 7, here in chapter 9, they kept saying, well, we know who his father is. We know this about him. We know that about him. And then all of a sudden they say, well, we don't know. So they're contradicting themselves in this whole process. You have the most amazing things that are happening in this day and age. You have miracles that are occurring that have never been seen by the world up to this point. The man even says that. Not since the beginning. And where is he quoting, or why is he saying this? Because he knows the scriptures. He says, look, my knowledge of the scriptures, this never happened before. Never seen this before anywhere. And so they can't grasp everything that he's given them. The signs, the wonders, the fact that he's not doing it on his own behalf, that he's doing it for God, that he is speaking as the oracles of God, all these different things, and they can't grasp it. So we talked a little bit about this last week, about this idea of unbelief. And it's unbelievers who tend to prosecute believers more than anybody in the world. There was a church in Nigeria, I think, a couple of weeks ago. Gunmen went in on a Sunday, killed 80 people in there because they didn't like them. People who are just kind of walking through life and they don't know if God exists or doesn't exist, they're usually not the person who's going to have that adamancy about this. It's the unbeliever. And we're going to see in a little while that God does something with those unbelievers when it's time to judge those unbelievers. And we're going to see something that gets pointed out. And I missed this the first couple of times I read this, but we're going to look at that in just a minute. Okay. So what he is saying here is that, why is this astonishing fact? Literally, in this is the marvel. In this act that you see, there is a marvel that is going on. That you, who pretend to know so much, do not know where he hails from, or literally where he is from, and yet he has opened my eyes. Yes. That's correct. Yeah, he's going back to, that's a good point. It's not in what happened that's the marvel. It's that we can see this, and yet you don't know anything about him. This guy is literally among you, and he's doing these things, and you have no clue who he is, even though he's given them all sorts of evidences. Okay, so verses 31, 32, and 33, and this is going to be the critical point of all of this. The healed man continues, "We know that God does not listen to sinners." Okay. God does not listen to sinners. So when I was not a Christian and I was seeking God, I was a sinner, and I was praying to God that I could find what I needed in my life to be healed and accepted and obedient to him, but I was a sinner. I hadn't been baptized yet. So what's he saying here that God does not listen to sinners? Because we've all been there, right? Every one of us was in a state where we were a sinner and we reached out to God in prayer because we are lifting ourselves up to him.
The sacrifices of the unjust, the pleadings, the songs of the unjust are just noise to me. I mean, there's a lot of different Old Testament examples when God has basically stopped listening to his people.
Okay. But what was the requirement for that, Aaron?
Of them, okay, I'm sorry. What was the requirement of God listening to them, or why wasn't God listening?
So let me throw it this way. Okay, we've been talking about Gideon. Gideon tested God how many times? Three times. Angel comes to him and says, "Here's what you're going to do." Gideon says, "Just a minute, I need to check on a few things." Then he tests God. Was Gideon a God-fearing man?
Probably one of the only ones.
What was Gideon's question when the angel of the Lord came to him and says, "You, O mighty warrior, you're going to deliver your people"? I'm paraphrasing, of course. Yeah. I'm ready for the... He makes a comment about God. What does he say about God? Yeah, where's he been? So it sounds like there's a little unbelief there, in my opinion. So I think the clarifier is this next phrase. "But if anyone is God-fearing and does his will..." Now, this is important, because can I fear God and still not do his will? Absolutely. Can I say that I know that God exists, that I believe in heaven and hell, and I believe that if I don't follow him, I'm going to be judged in damnation for eternity, and yet still go over here and do these things? Yeah, you can do that.
There's too many people with...
What's that? There's too many...
So many people do the various things.
They do that, right? So the sinner idea here is, to me, the person who is a purposed sinner. The one who has purposed that they are going to continue or be in a life that is going to be the antithesis of what God has desired for us. In other words, the unbeliever. And so he's using this point to give them the very last syllogistic argument that we're going to look at. And he says that since the world began, it was never heard of that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So this is an argument against their own arguments. And now we have a very strengthened universal syllogism that has occurred. Let me get signed back in. I think I have it on here. I hope I have it on here. I guess I should have checked that. Why can't I? Well, I'll do it this way. Where do I put the... I have to turn around then. No, I can't do that either. Sorry. I brailed up the climax and then I kind of balloon loose that air. Okay. So syllogism A, expanded, only people born who are from God can open the eyes of the bulls born blind. This man Jesus is not from God. He cannot have opened the eyes of one born blind. So we have... Did I put it on here? I did not. Okay. So we have this final argument. Okay, so verse 31 is your major premise. Verse 32 is your minor premise. And verse 33 is the conclusion. So let's look through this. Verse 31 says, what? Somebody read verse 31 to me.
Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and doeth his will, he heareth.
Okay. So the premise is this. Only people who are from God, in other words, those who are God-fearing, and literally in the Greek here, it's God-worshipping, and do his will, are heard by God so that they can open the eyes of those born blind. Okay, that's the major premise he just said. Only people who are from God, who are God-fearing and do his will, are heard by God so that they can open the eyes of those born blind. Okay, verse 32, let's read that one. Okay, so your minor premise is this. This man, Jesus, who was heard by God so that he opened the eyes of one born blind and thus performed a miracle so great that since the world began, or the literal translation is from the age or from of old, it was never heard of. Therefore, the conclusion, Aaron, verse 33. Oh, you don't have your Bible. Okay, verse 33, Eric. Okay, so the conclusion is right there in verse 33. This man is from God. If he were not, he could do nothing. He is definitely not a sinner. So he just took a principle and an argumentative base that they kept trying to throw at him, and he turned it all around, and he made a universal truth. And they could say nothing after this. Now, this is not somebody who didn't have a little bit of smarts, which we talked about a little bit the other day. He's been a beggar, he's blind, yet he has a tremendous knowledge of the scriptures and of the purpose behind the scriptures. Now, this is, if you've known anybody who's been blind their whole life, their other senses are just phenomenal. And their ability to memorize things is just absolutely stunning. I can see it and I'll forget it in about 10 minutes. So he comes up and he says that I'm going to use your argument against you. Everything that you have been saying and everything you've been trying to trap me, here's the answer I'm going to give you. So their response to him is, you're a poopy head, get out. Because that's pretty much all they could say at this point in time. And if we think about this, he makes a statement that it sort of implies something here. He says, God doesn't listen to sinners, only those that are God-fearing and have the will to do his will. So in other words, was the blind man praying to God that his eyes might be opened? Because obviously it comes to pass. There's a possibility there that he was participating in this miracle as an answer to his own prayer. Because he makes it very clear that God doesn't listen to anybody who's a sinner, but only those that are God-fearing and those who do his will. And this is a very scriptural point. I'm not going to go through all the scriptures, but you have 1 Samuel 8, Job 27, Psalms 18, Proverbs 1, Proverbs 15, Isaiah 1, Isaiah 59, Jeremiah, on and on and on. Notice I'm also quoting from the Old Testament, because that's what they would have had. So the Pharisees have suffered a defeat, a humiliating defeat at this point in time. But the beggar has made a progress in his own spiritual walk because he has come to a place where he has defied this institution of government, if you will. He is not saying at this point in time whether Jesus is the sinner. I do not know. He just came up with the answer to his very question, or his very statement, I should say. It can't be, because if he is from God and he has done this, therefore he is not a sinner. So by this time, he knows that Jesus is not a sinner, but the recipient of God's favor in a very high degree. So having lost the argument, the Pharisees resort to arrogant, glaring abuse. They said to him, "You were wholly born in sin, weren't you?" And why did they say that? Because he was blind. Now here's, remember the start of all of this? You weren't really blind, were you? Was he really blind? Can you tell if he was really blind? Well, now they come back and say, well, you've been born in sin. So therefore, they have now acknowledged that he was blind. If I was a lawyer looking at this, I'd be like, what? Are you listening to yourselves? So they tried to abuse him, and they decide at the end they are going to kick him out of the synagogue. They've excommunicated him. We don't see at this point how he feels about it. We just happen to see that this has happened. Jesus knows that this has happened because Jesus now approaches the blind man and has a conversation with him. So in verse 35, Jesus heard that they had thrown him out and having found him said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" What's the Son of Man? You can't answer. Yes.
Mine says, "Do you believe in the Son of God?"
Okay.
That's what translation
are you reading? The New American. Yeah. The translation is actually Son of Man. It's not Son of Yahweh. It's Son of Man. Yeah. And he said, "Who is he, sir? Tell me in order that I might believe in him." Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. In fact, the one who is speaking to you is he." And he said, "I believe, Lord," and he worshiped him. Now, there's something interesting in the Greek in verse 36 when he said, when he talks about him and he, it's the word kyrios, which is the same word that he's using in verse 38, which is the word Lord. But it's not in the same presence, right? You would call somebody Lord, but it wasn't meant in the sense of a spiritual Lord. you've been banned.
The blind man, ex-blind man, had an understanding of the question that Jesus asked him. Do you believe in the Son of Man? He understood that terminology to have a specific reference. There's the question.
Yep, that is a great point. So I will give you this before class ends tonight. The term Son of Man occurs 80 times in the Gospels. In the fourth Gospel, it is found 13 times, or 11 if you want to debate 5:27 and 9:35. I'm going to give you the list next week. I'm going to print this up for you. Jesus is the only person who ever said this. It was a self-designation. There is nobody else that calls him the Son of Man. He only called himself the Son of Man. He used this to reference himself throughout the text that we've already come up to, and the people understood that it would refer to the Christ. They understood this in the Old Testament. And so it was not new to them, and we're going to see this when we get to John chapter 12. In verse 34, it's implied that the Jews knew who the Son of Man was. So when he called himself the Son of Man, as Gil pointed out, this was not like, what? What does that mean? We don't understand that. They knew. They knew. Just like Aaron talked about baptism. You know, John's out there baptizing at the Jordan. They didn't go out there and go, "Can you tell me what this baptism thing is? We've never seen this before. You know, we'll pay the fare to get in and do the, you know, whatever." But no, they knew what baptism was. They understood the concept of it. And we sort of forget that sometimes, that this is not, these are not rhetorics that they weren't familiar with. So before we end, I wanted to share with you a couple of things that I came across. At this point in the story, with Jesus talking to him, we're moving from physical blindness to spiritual blindness. It's a shift now. Blindness is used throughout the Bible to talk about the human condition of corruption, of the idea of man being fallen and the inability to comprehend God and divine truth. Now, this is important, and I want you to see what I said, the inability to see God and divine truth. We're all blinded by sin, but we don't stay in a blinded state when we come out of that sin through our faith and obedience and our relationship change. The blindness we're talking about here, that he's going to bring and show the people and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, it's an inability for them to move past that blindness. So there's a third type of blindness that we have. We have physical blindness, we have spiritual blindness, and we have judgmental blindness. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. And I'm going to have to run it by the elders first to make sure that I get my points right so I don't get accused of saying something I shouldn't. But we're going to look at that next week. So just keep in mind that this idea of blindness is something we're going to see a lot in the scriptures. I will get you a list of where he calls himself the Son of Man, but here's what I want you to do, if you don't mind doing this next week. You can go through and you can see definitions of the Son of Man played out in the book of John. So if you take the time, go back through what we've already read, go up through chapter 12, you're going to see definitions. And you're going to be able to pull out, when we say the Son of Man, you're going to be able to say, okay, the Son of Man is this, 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 this. And let's see if you can find the same things that I was able to uncover. Okay? Any questions, thoughts? All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for everybody on live stream. It was nice being here in front of you this evening. Hopefully you were able to learn a few things about the blind man.